This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Here we are. Hi folks, this is Richard Hall and this is the Night Sky. And as usual, I've got that other person with me. What's her name? Kay Leather. That's the one, isn't it? But this evening is going to be rather special. Just to explain a few things before we go on, just to remind people, we've got the Dave Flynn concert coming up. It's at 7 o'clock Thursday, March the 14th. So if you're interested in coming along to that, just give Stonehenge a call.
Anywhere else? Either you can book through our website, you know, the booking system connected to the website, or Event Finder.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Some people are more familiar with Event Finder.
Okay, but I guess what the main thing I wanted to really discuss this morning was this wonderful night sky that we've got, and the fact that we've just been awarded Dark Sky. How do we call it? Dark Sky Reserve. And I've got some special people working with me, and I'll introduce them in a moment. But the photograph you can see on TV at the moment, that's actually been taken from the Wairarapa a year or so ago, and it's something that we tend to take for granted, but the vast majority of people never see a night sky like that. And what we do need is to preserve it, all right? And here's another beautiful photograph. So it's the Wairarapa Dark Sky Reserve, and there's been a team of people who've been working together to get us turned into a reserve. I've got a picture of some of them there. There's the boss there.
Don't know about that.
Well, you're not there.
Yeah, okay, so that's what it's all about. So anyway, with us today, we've got Viv. I'll just turn that on. See if we go. Hello, Viv.
Hi.
Have you turned the camera on?
I'll get it right in a moment.
Oh, here's a technical expert.
Ah, no, he's got it.
Okay, well, look, I've got a nice picture. Oh, look, there they are there. Viv and Charlotte hiding here. Okay. And these two people have played a major role in the development of this Dark Sky Reserve. And incidentally, the reason why I came to the Wairarapa in the first place, because I used to work at Carter Observatory, was simply because it was an hour and a quarter's drive and you had these magnificent night skies. But the important thing is what we've got to do is preserve that. Mm. And it's something that nobody else has seen for a while. Okay. So let's have a look. So what is a dark sky reserve?
Go for it, Viv.
A dark sky reserve is awarded to areas by what used to be called the International Dark Sky Association, based in Tucson, Arizona, and now is called Dark Sky International. Mm-hmm. And you have to go through a very rigorous process, application process, which I think basically from when we decided that it was a good thing to go ahead and try and become a dark sky reserve, it took about five and a half years. So there's a lot of work that has to go into it, and it was, as you touched on, Richard, a small group of people who did an amazing amount of work to make sure that we met all the criteria, which in the end we did. There was a lot of I dotting, T crossing, and Charlotte was right there in the thick of it, trying to make sure that everything we put in was at the level that the Dark Sky Association was expecting. And we did have to go through a number of revamps or a number of drafts, but in the end we got there. So, and the whole thing about the Dark Sky Reserve is, as you touched on, is actually trying to ensure that we keep those dark skies that we have in here in the Wairarapa, and by looking after our night sky by making some rules that people can't go and just light up and put lots of neon lights everywhere. And so, the key is conservation of our sky. Mm.
I always think it's something that we just tend to take for granted. he and a wife. I can always remember a young woman coming out to Stonehenge. She was an American woman, and she stopped in Carterton, not in Carterton district, in the countryside, but actually in the town. And she said, I went out last night. She said, I looked up and I was absolutely stunned. Now, she was in her early 30s. She'd never seen the Milky Way before. She said, where I come from in the States, it's just orange lights as far as you can see. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is, as you say, we take it for granted. And I had a similar experience when quite a few years ago when my kids were at Kurinui and they had an exchange student from Japan staying with us. And we came home one night and she looked up. We hadn't really noticed she'd looked up at the sky, but she suddenly burst into tears. And we thought, oh, my goodness, what on earth have we done to upset her? And she said, are those stars? And just sat outside and just for about an hour just could not believe that she'd never seen stars. She lived in the middle of Tokyo.
Yeah. Look, I was much the same. I mean, because I used to live near London, you know, and you had to travel some distance out to really get a good view of the night sky. So what would you say the overall benefits to the members, that people living in the Wairarapa are, of having this reserve?
I think basically what we've touched on is that now there are some rules in place to ensure that lighting can't go, as I said, you can't get bright lights pointing up to the sky, so making that light pollution. And so hopefully that means that our kids and grandkids and further generations will actually continue to have what we have now, which we take for granted, but so many other people in the world would actually be completely amazed by it.
Mm. And it's also saving as well, because I always say to people when they come out to Stonehenge, on a dark night, if you look towards Masterton, you can see, or if it's a cloudy night, and you can see all the clouds illuminated, why are the ratepayers paying to illuminate the clouds?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Well, it's all that energy that you're paying for, which is going upwards.
Yeah.
And so if you put the proper shielding on, you cut the wattage right down, and that saves you lots of money.
Yeah, the other thing too is the wildlife. I mean, just life around is benefits a great deal. It's all evolved to have a night and a day cycle.
Yeah.
And suddenly when there isn't any night, trees even, it's been found, don't flourish as well if they're exposed to continuous light sources. And certainly, I mean, there's some insects you're not terribly keen on, but there's lots of beneficial insects that we do want to have quite happy, you know, pollinating our plants and things like that. And there's animals as well that are quite badly affected, not just human animals, but other animals as well. Mm. That don't do well if they just can't find a nice dark spot to hide in.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And New Zealand's blessed with a lot of native nocturnal wildlife.
Yeah.
And animals are, you know, national icon is one of them. And so when you think about that, I think what we have a beautiful opportunity to do right now, because we have, obviously we do all take it for granted here in the Wairarapa because we've been so lucky to have an amazing dark sky. But I think the most important thing that we can do as a group now is the education piece around what light pollution is and with the why behind that. So it's not just that we go out and we step out of our back doors, and we're really lucky, even if you're in a town, to be able to do that and look up and see the Milky Way quite happily. But it's the piece about protection and, you know, sort of education around why we're protecting and how to protect, and then getting people really switched on, pardon the pun, for making good decisions. So, you know, we all just go and buy a light bulb and don't think too much about it. But if we can educate them to make good choices, and then our children are very aware, and that's a really big piece of the why, and to understand light pollution. And everybody, you know, talks about light pollution being one of the ones that's the simplest to reverse.
Yeah.
So why not embrace that good luck opportunity and be able to feel like we can make a difference and protect it and keep that going? And, you know, the work we have to do is keeping where we've started from, but there's no like we can aspire to get even better and and more darker. And you know, it's lovely. Now we've become a reserve. People will often get in touch with the association through our emails and highlight something that they're concerned about, because people are starting to realise and to look around at night with a whole new lens on what you see. So we'll often get people, and we're usually aware and involved, but it's really lovely that people are now sort of being advocates for the work we've done, and that's become a bigger piece.
I think everybody's become a night sky guide.
Yes.
I don't think it's just tourists. You know, not operators.
No.
I think everybody who pops out with their visitor from wherever is, to one extent or another, becoming a dark sky guide and sort of pointing bits out. And they can remember their parents pointing them out to them, and they're rediscovering knowledge that they pretty much forgot.
Yeah. Totally. I think we all have a story about something where at some point in your childhood or in your life that you've looked up, and because you look up in awe, and wherever you are in the world, like I grew up in England, but I can remember being shown Orion's Belt. Mm. And so obviously when I came here, it's upside down. But it was one of the first things I could get my head round, and it was imprinted that, like, Dad had shown me this. And so I do that with my son, and we're all ambassadors of this.
I think so.
Because it makes you feel so small to be on the earth.
You can save your lives too.
You do realise that was a Eurocentric comment.
But I think the sky has a magic about it, and so you can't help but be captivated. And I think, you know, that is the magic about a project like this, that there's the environmental aspect. So there's so many ways that you become passionate, whether it be the stars, the environment, the wildlife, the protection of the planet. It's just a beautiful project to be involved in.
Mm. And for me, I think it's wonderful how, although it's taken a bit of time, it's actually been constructed quite rapidly. And I look at some other places around the world where, when I was a kid, for example, looking at Africa and places like that, and thinking, I've got to do something about this, that and the other. And now we're talking about extinction of different creatures, which once upon a time were abundant. Unfortunately, human beings often seem to take their time to, they have to be kicked somewhere, I won't use the word, before they actually do something.
Yeah, it is a long time, but anything, I suppose, in hindsight, as we look back on the work that's been done in the five to six years, you know, and it's always the same. Like, there's a group of dedicated volunteers that give their time to projects like this. It's like a passion project for a small group. But now, as we said, the ambassadors will start coming on board just from what we've achieved, and it will flourish, hopefully, into the future and go on much further than any of us will.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk about having locator beacons and things like that, but, you know, a simple knowledge of Orion's Belt rising in the east and setting in the west. I mean, if you can find east and west, you can find north and south.
Yeah.
I mean, your nose is pointing one way, the back of your head's pointing the other way.
Yeah. And so, it's all of that, isn't it?
There are actually practical ways of practical. Just fallback stuff that enable you to basically get out of trouble until you can recognise something.
Yeah.
Well, this is something that we tend to forget, that once upon a time, there was a time when, as kids, we would have been taught the night sky. You know, it was just been something everyone would have learned, to find your way home if you needed to, using the sun, the moon and the stars, particularly learning seasons and seasonal changes, what type of weather to expect, can all be told by looking at the stars and so on. So these sorts of things were valuable, and we've all taught it, but these days we're not, are we?
No, you get out your phone.
It's all provided for us.
And I don't think people are... I think it's slowly the significance is going back to that. But you look at all cultures around the world as well. I mean, it's all tied into
it's life
nature.
And death.
And it's all tied into, I mean, you know, Matriki, Maramataka. You look at all of that knowledge and wisdom that we have right here in New Zealand, and, you know, farming and sailing, and, you know, it's just, and that's a beautiful story to tell. And so there's so much wisdom that we can tap into through ancient
wisdom. Yeah, and I'm very keen for that to come back. You mentioned Matariki; that's actually a good example. You know, because a lot of Europeans wonder, well, what's it all about? But what most Europeans don't realise is that if you're going back several thousands of years, Matariki marked the beginning of the year for all the peoples of Europe and Asia. And it's a tradition that was brought into the Pacific when people migrated into the Pacific. That's how it occurred. And the reason why it was so important is its rising heralded the spring equinox, which marked the beginning of the year and the return of life on Earth following the harsh Northern Hemisphere winter. But we're not told those sorts of things. We just start with Matariki, so...
And it's so much easier to follow a straightforward Gregorian 365 days, and this is what happens. And, but, you know, you have to get curious, and I think that's what the night sky enables you to do. It's a beautiful opener to curiosity and the universe and its vastness. So, it's exciting.
So asking some questions on behalf of the public, are there disadvantages?
You can bring them up, eh?
So, for example, what about the ordinary person living here? How will it affect them, as it were?
Oh, I can only think for the benefit. Sort of, it's just a beautiful addition to living currently in the South Wairarapa and Carterton district to say that you live in a dark sky reserve. And I think I can't see any cons to the situation. I mean, sort of, like you touched on, Richard, sort of the cost and energy that goes into sort of lighting up clouds, nobody really wants to waste. So it's all about getting to know what's good moves in lighting and making smart choices, which is effectively going to save you money or make sense for a bigger picture. So I've really struggled to find anything that would be negative in this space.
Well, for some people, I think... I'm going to be in the dark. Of course, it's not. It's actually having the correct lighting. It's not about having no lighting, isn't it?
Yeah. It's about reducing glare, probably more than anything, isn't it?
We're definitely not the light police of the Wairarapa. And I think, there might have been a bit of misconception there. But we don't expect people to put lights off at 10 o'clock at night and us all be sat by candlelight. We're not against lighting. One thing that just came to mind was that, you know, there's areas that lighting is perceived as safety. Sometimes there's a link that we tend to correlate with being brightly lit with being safe. But actually, there's been studies that show sort of like in streets that are super brightly lit, because that creates the glare. You can't actually see properly. So CCTV cameras, for instance, can't pick things up. Whereas if lights are shielded and put down to where they're needed to, you see a lot more. So it's actually a myth-busting sort of scenario. Mm-hmm. There's studies that prove that that is not the case. And the study's been done in Europe and in America that prove that crime rates can actually go down with lighting that's more in line with a dark sky reserve sort of criteria, where it's shielded, it's pointed down. We're all about lights being used in the right place at the right time. So nobody gets any benefit from shining lights up into the sky. It doesn't nothing. You need them where you need them to see, to walk, to be safe, to get around. And on timers is the genius thing, because then they're only used when they need to be, where the people are around. So
in senses.
And we're not against light. It's just being smart. And we like smart people, so... I think there should be more of them on the
planet. And I think, too, lighting manufacturers appear to be getting all of this on board, too, and coming up with new ways of doing lighting that is more appropriate for lighting conservation.
Yeah, because one of the questions we have from people is, will I have to change my lights, the lights around my home?
No. I mean, all we suggest to, we do work with businesses and groups a lot more, and that's the space we can sort of make a lot of impact in working with councils and things. But from a resident perspective in your everyday home, and if you've got outdoor lights, it's just about sort of that education piece of, what does it mean? And we've got a lovely brochure that goes out to all the different towns, and we share in details on our Facebook and website. But it's all about sort of the basic rules are shielding the light so it goes down to where it's needed, like we just said, so it doesn't shine up, and having a warmer light. So instead of those cold lights, those cold sort of white lights that became a bit of a thing a few years back, sort of it's that warmer, sort of softer glow of light. So back to the, you know, the red lights as opposed to the blue light. Mm-hmm. And so it's really simple. It's not rocket science to be able to make some changes. And, you know, working with, we've got a piece of work at the moment that will get us working with electricians and suppliers, but also like the Mitre 10s and the supermarkets to try and like make it really simple when people are making choices. And like Viv said, lighting manufacturers in the time we've been doing this work, it's not about changing.
It's not necessarily about changing the lights now. It's when you
go to replace
get,
them,
you get the correct lighting, and it's as simple as that, isn't it? Really,
and it's cheaper.
Or either otherwise putting a shade on them.
Yeah,
I mean it's that is, I think, one of the amazing things about this is that if you're not trying to get every little particle of plastic that's floating around the ocean, it's very, very, very easy to actually protect and stop that light going up into the sky. And it's simple and it's basically cheap. I mean, you can get very cheap light shades.
Oh, another question came from, how will it affect new builds, new buildings?
New buildings do have new lighting rules on them. When a subdivision goes through or a change of use of a piece of land and there is a resource consent that goes with that, there's new lighting, the new rules which are governed by the number of lumens. So that's quite technical. But So those, when you get a resource consent, you should get, in Carterton and South Wairarapa, you should get information from the council explaining what the new rules are and how you can meet those new rules.
Excellent.
But we're not going to go back and ask people to change all their lights, as we said before. Yeah, but when you're coming to buy a new light bulb or whatever, think about it.
We've answered to some degree this next question. Will there be enough light for me to be safe on the footpath at night?
Yeah.
I think Charlotte's already been into that. But actually, lighting, bright lighting is more to the advantage of the criminal, isn't it?
It is in that way. But obviously, you know, in that we don't want, you know, we're aware that lighting needs to be correct and we don't want people having accidents and things. And that's where our job is also as an association to work with councils. I mean, there's often areas that are perceived as not having enough lighting, but that hasn't been by the process of becoming a dark sky reserve. It's just that actually that lighting has never been sort of just suitable or enough for the space that it was. Like, there's a couple of areas in South Wairarapa that will be commented on, but it's just that hasn't had any impact from becoming a dark sky reserve. It's been what it always is. So we can work with councils to advocate for making that a safer, more lighting. Like, there's a couple of projects currently on the go where lighting are involved, and that is increasing lighting, but it's just to be done in accordance with what the reserve needs. So yeah, sort of again.
Another one was, what about shop advertising? As a lit that lights up the sky and that sort of thing. What sort of controls will be coming in on that?
I think that's just more of a working with people and about education and awareness. I think we're quite lucky. We don't really have a lot of that. Huge and in that retail space.
You've had a lot of very positive responses, haven't you? From big organisation.
How can we, what do we need to consider? It's more of a proactive sort of angle that I find here in the Wairarapa. And that even, which is really heartening, is in Masterton, which is currently not yet within the reserve, but is an aspiration to become. And they're working on starting that process. And so I think people are more wanting to know what they can do to achieve, like, being sort of where they need to be. So, yeah, I think we're really lucky, and it's been, you know, once we've got there, and it was a long sort of long trek, but now we're there, people are really going like, how can we help? Yeah. What can we do? So, which is great.
Mm. And then a question, well, it's sort of similar lines. What about sports ground lighting?
Well, sports ground lighting, there are some new rules about that, but when the... because what had to happen was there had to be a plan change under the Resource Management Act. And when that was going through, a couple of the sports bodies actually made submissions on that plan. And through the process that was negotiated, you know, there's a time limit, I think, of 10 o'clock at night. So all sporting, for example, at Clerval Hockey, finishes at 10 o'clock at night. And as long as that happens, then the sports lighting is not affected in any way. You can have that temporary type of lighting because they switch it all off. They don't want to be running those amazingly strong, strong lights, which must cost a fortune for them, when they don't have to. So, you know, that was negotiated through the process of changing the rules.
Excellent. That really covers a lot of the questions we have in public. Just a few other things. What had to be done to achieve reserve status? So what was it all about? What did you have to do?
How long have we got? there was different elements of the application process. So there was a big piece was the lighting inventory. So we had to create a register of all public lighting. So that was quite a big task, given that the space that we decided to apply for. So that included state highway lighting, things like lighthouses, public lighting in each of the two districts, so schools, parks,
railway stations,
like all of those public areas, parks that had lights, a big piece. And obviously, you know, it's quite a unique situation, our situation. We have a state highway, we've got towns with lots of lights and lots of things, as opposed to some of the dark sky reserves in other areas of the world, which are quite remote and just land. So there was lots of facets in that. So there was a massive lighting inventory. There was public engagement, so we had to get out and talk and advocate for what we were doing. The piece with the council, the district plan change, was a big piece of the work. Mm. What else? Sort of the relationship building. So we have, like I said, because we've got state highway lighting, we've got lighthouses, so we have to have relationships with Maritime New Zealand, NZTA, DOC, our core. We have a core in the reserve, which is Aorangi Forest Park, which is governed by DOC. So we have to have so many relationships, and so it's building really robust relationships with those people to be able to, because it's not just our little team doing the work. We have to work with those people going forward all the time to make sure that they're doing their bit as well. So there's a lot of that.
We had to do light readings as well.
And that will continue to be that way, though, won't it?
Always, yeah. Forever. And yeah. Light readings, yeah. So we had to monitor the sky. So we had to get readings done at the core and also at different areas. And we've got these things called test meters that are spread out across the region. And so we're constantly reading what the sky is doing, which is, you know, an interesting one, because to read the sky, actually, you know, you're asking people to go out quite late at night at certain times. We like to do it around a new moon, and sometimes the weather can be a little bit challenging in that space. So so there's, you know, when you're working with Mother Nature, you've got a partner that sometimes doesn't play ball. So there was all of that, and so collating a lot of data, the report in itself, maps, we had to get mapping done. There was a lot of things, and you look back now and realise that that's why it took so long, because some of these processes don't happen overnight. It's, you know, time was invested. So,
and yeah, with the inventory, you had to actually do a daytime photograph and a GPS and then a nighttime reading of what the light was, its brightness, all of these sort of things. Yeah. So that meant two trips, basically, to each individual light.
Yeah.
So that, yeah.
And borrowing kit. So we had to borrow a very specific piece of kit to do one part of the reading element. And there's not many of those in New Zealand. We had the opportunity to borrow a piece of kit, but that was also based on when we could have a slot to use it. So just there was lots to do, but we got there. We did it.
Mm-hmm. I can also remember signage. You know, at one of the meetings that I was at, you're talking about signage going over the Rimutakas and things like that.
Yeah.
And there were very specific rules.
Yes, well, that's the current project. Because that was something that didn't come into play in the application, but has come into play since having reserve status. So part of the criteria is we actually have some signage. So, and yes, you would not believe how much thought has to go into but we'll get there, and very, very soon, hopefully in the next few months, you will see some beautifully welcome signs to the Wairarapa Dark Sky Reserve. So,
and I think that's important too, Richard, that now we have an obligation with Dark Sky International that we have to furnish a report at the end of each year, calendar year, and there are, once again, set criteria about what we have to do, and so some of that is keeping our light monitoring going all through the year, and our education and our community outreach. So it's not, you don't just get the reserve and then say, oh, thank goodness we've got that. You actually have to do things to keep it.
Do you have to improve?
Don't have to improve, but the aspiration is if you can, because from a night glow perspective.
Mm. Yeah, we've got less than a minute to go, about 30 seconds.
Oh my goodness,
yeah. It's gone so fast.
So is there a special word or you'd like to say just to finish up?
Oh, I just thank you for having us and the opportunity to come and chat. And it's been a great opportunity. But reach out if you're interested. Check out Wairarapa Dark Sky. .nz and find out more and get in touch.
Lovely. And thank you to everyone for their support and encouragement.
Yeah.
Mm. That's it, folks. Now we'll come back with a night sky fairly about 2 weeks from now. We get back in, but I'd like to thank these people. I've been working with them as well, and it's wonderful to actually achieve this in the Wairarapa, and that's just a starting point. With that, I've a bit of
and those people you saw in the picture that are not here.
Yeah.